So they're going to brief us on the Tri-5-5, which is going to do the preschool child development and the ECD census report. And then after that, we are going to have the committee deliberations and engagement. And then after that, we are going to consider the minutes of the previous meeting. Can I then have the adoption of the agenda? Someone to adopt the agenda? Whip, Comrade at once.
Then I was raising my hand.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning to your good self. Good morning to the DM. I see the DM. If the minister is here also, good morning to the minister, Me Angie Mutseha, the DG, Mr. Mweli, and all the officials of the department, all the members of the portfolio committee, our support staff, good morning. I move to adopt the agenda as it is, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Tia.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning to everybody, the minister, the deputy minister, the department, and everybody on the platform, and the new member, the Fry, Honorable Fry. Good morning to you. I second the agenda as it is. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Litsie. I don't see the minister in the meeting. Or am I DM?
Good morning. I thought the minister is in the meeting. Maybe she's still trying to join. But
no, education. She's not in now.
Okay.
Let's give over to you then to just do the political brief.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. And good morning to you, Chairperson. Good morning to the members. Minister is already in the meeting. Minister, please, can you take over? We're just greeting and introducing our team when we're still joining the meeting. I indicated that you are still joining the meeting. Over to you, Minister, through the permission of the Chair.
Okay. DM, I think you've represented us well. Chair, I'm sorry to join late. I was struggling with the connectivity. I think my connection is
fragile.
I can give you a run for your life. let me apologize and thank you very much for the invitation, Chair. Let me not waste your time. And thank you again for inviting us to this meeting. And I'm very excited on the subjects we're going to discuss, subjects which I think have re-energized the sector and ourselves. And I hope you'll also be equally excited as us in the areas that we're going to be talking about. I don't want to take much of your time, Chair, except to thank you very much for giving us an opportunity to engage yourself on the matters that are on the agenda. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Minister. Gigi, welcome back.
Thank you, Chair. It's indeed a feeling of homecoming after being on leave for a very long time. I want to thank the minister and the DM for having allowed me the most needed when I did not realize. I just thought that I must just go on working. And thank the team for having been able to hold the fort exceptionally well. And Dr. Whittle in particular, who's also in this meeting, greet you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, Honorable Minister and Deputy Minister and colleagues. Today, we presenting, we're giving two presentations, which are actually one, as the minister said. We've now received ECD as part of the mandate of basic education and as part of preparing in earnest for really making sure that we come up with a new delivery model, is to understand the fundamentals of ECD. And it really begins, Chair, although it's coincidental, with what you have elected to have the meeting briefed on today. The information that is going to be shared is very crucial to getting the fundamentals of ECD understood. And the Thrive by Five will give you a sense of what are the issues that we really need to address from ECD, and to give you some diagnosis of what this responsibility should involve in going forward for basic education. So this will be presented by Sonja from Data Drive 2030. I'm sorry, it will be presented by Jan Schenk from ICAPA Data. And then the second part, which is on ECD census, will be presented by Sonja. Just to indicate, Chair, that an update on ECD will come in the next term, as you correctly pointed out in your opening remarks. Be finalizing that, getting it ready for you. But today we are presenting on Thrive by Five and also the ECD census, which I believe are very crucial in getting the fundamentals right in ECD as we move forward. Dr. Whittle has been requested to lead the team because Mrs. Gaya is out of the country together with the chief director. I'm also traveling to Limpopo to do the usual work of infrastructure sanitation that the minister, deputy minister, and the portfolio committee requested me to do. I'm on my way to Limpopo. I'll be working in Limpopo for this week. In case I get cut, the leadership will just move seamlessly. Dr. Whittle will just take over and lead the team in doing these two presentations. I'm going to request that we start with the first one, Thrive by Five. Jan, we can start, and then after that, immediately followed by Sonja, without any interruption, then we proceed. Over to you, Jan.
Thank you. I'm actually would be presenting the EC census results. I'm happy to do that now. But if you want to start with the Thrive by Five, then Sonja would be the one doing that presentation.
I'm sorry to confuse the two, but any of.
Okay, Mama.
Thank you. I'll go ahead with the Thrive by Five.
There's no.
Hello, colleagues. My name's Sonja. I'll be doing a presentation on the Thrive by Five. Can I go ahead? So, Honourable Minister.
Yes, you can go ahead, Sonja.
Thank you. Honourable Minister, DG, Honourable Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee and colleagues from the Department of Basic Education. It's really wonderful to be here and fantastic to be presenting this exciting work. I'm going to share my screen. I hope it works. Right. So the Thrive by Five Index was launched on the 8th of April this year. So it's really new. And it was a collaborative venture between the Department of Basic Education and a number of other key stakeholders. And I think what was really exciting characteristic of this index is that it is a multi-sectoral partnership, and we're hoping that it will remain that way moving forward. Now, as a country, we measure many things that tell us how well or poorly we are doing. We track unemployment rates. We look at business confidence. Within education, obviously, we place a lot of emphasis on matric results and learner throughput. But what we've never looked at or had data to report on is whether our young children are actually entering the schooling system and their learning journey with the right foundations in place. And this is essentially what the Thrive by Five Index aimed to address, this gap. We wanted to understand whether right from the start, we're actually setting up our young children for success. There were about 1.3 million children aged 4 to 5 years in South Africa, and about 70% of these children attend some kind of an early learning program. And these programs are often called preschools or creches or educare or playgroups. And we wanted to have a representative sample of children from children enrolled in early learning programs. Now, before the census, which Jan's going to speak to a little bit later, we didn't actually have a full database of all early learning programs. And so we worked with the Department of Basic Education to select a random sample of primary schools across the country. And then we identified all the early learning programs that we could find within a 5 to 10 kilometer radius of each of these schools. And we randomly selected 1,247 early learning programs nationally. And then out of those early learning programs, we selected 2 boys and 2 girls within each program. So over 5,000 children were included in the survey. It's the largest survey of child outcomes ever undertaken in South Africa at a preschool level. Every single one of these 5,000 plus children was individually assessed in their mother tongue using locally developed FAIR preschool assessment tools. And each child spent about an hour with each assessor. So the final weighted sample allows us to very reliably report on the percentage of children aged 4 to 5 years who are enrolled in an early learning program, who are at the age appropriate level in terms of very important key areas of early development. This information can be presented nationally, which is really where I'll focus today, but it can also be disaggregated by province. So the data, the sampling strategy was designed to ensure provincial representativity. And we can also look at it by income quintiles, which I'll speak to. And then obviously we're also able to look at the difference in performance between boys and girls. Now I'm just going to quickly give you an overview of what we actually spent that hour doing with each child. The first area that we looked at was early learning. And within this, we looked at 5 domains that we know from research, literature, evidence, to be associated with, to be important as children enter the foundation phase. So we looked at gross motor development, fine motor coordination and visual motor integration, numeracy and maths, early literacy and language, and cognition and executive functioning. The second area we looked at was the area of physical growth. Now, we couldn't do an overall assessment of each child's health, and so we focused on one measure, which was height for age. And this tells us whether a child is at risk of stunting, which is the result of chronic malnutrition. So it's not a comprehensive measure, but it's a reliable one. It's an internationally recognized one, and it's one that could be assessed at scale. So both early learning and physical growth involved a direct assessment with a trained assessor working with a young child for about an hour. The third area we looked at was social and emotional functioning. Now, it's very difficult for a stranger, however skilled or well-trained, to come into a program and meet a young child and assess their social emotional functioning. So to really give a fair measure of this, we asked each child's teacher to rate the child on a rating scale, which looked at 2 things, their social relations with peers and adults and their emotional readiness for school. Now, before I share the results of this extensive survey, I just wanted to remind everybody, and I'm sure colleagues on this call are very aware of this, but a child's development by the age of 4 to 5 years is a culmination of all of their life experiences up until that point. This is not just about education. This is whether the child had a healthy pregnancy, if the child's mother felt supported, if the child feels safe in her home, if she has adequate nutrition, if her parents read her stories or tell her stories, sing songs to her. All of these things are going to impact that child's development. We sampled children that were enrolled in early learning programs only because it wasn't possible to do samples at a household level. But we mustn't fall into the trap of seeing this as only an education issue. Education has a critical role to play, especially after the function shift. But part of that role is ensuring a multi-sectoral response. Okay, so let's have a look at the findings. At the end of the day, the final sample, once we had cleaned the data, included 5,139 children. Now, this is a very large sample, considering the type of data collection. And it's easy when you see such a big number to forget the fact that each of these numbers represents a little child, who's got hopes and dreams, excited about things. And so in order to make this more real, what I'm going to ask you to do is to imagine just 20 children. Imagine 20 children starting grade R at a school in January 2023. Now, on the basis of the information that we've collected here, this is what we know about those 20 children. 7 of the 20 children are thriving. What does that mean? It means that these children are on track, both in terms of their cognitive development, their early learning, as well as their physical development. So they're not showing signs of chronic malnutrition. 10 children out of these 20, so half of these 20 children coming into this grade R classroom, face barriers to thriving. These children are either not on track when it comes to their early learning, or they show signs of chronic malnutrition. 3 out of the 20 children face significant barriers to thriving. These 3 children are both chronically malnourished. They show signs of stunting, and they are unable to meet the requirements in terms of their early learning. Now, these 3 out of 20 children are very unlikely to catch up without significant intervention. So imagine this group of 20 children coming into a grade R classroom, and now extrapolate that up. We have about 850,000 children every year coming into grade R. So that means about 600,000 of these children are coming into the grade R classrooms without the right foundations in place. And that just gives us some sense of the enormity of the challenge. Now I'm going to look in a little bit more detail at each of those 3 areas I described. So I'm going to start with early learning, and then I'm going to speak about physical growth and then social emotional functioning. So for early learning, the tool that we use, the early learning outcomes measure, allows us to report on learning overall. So it gives us a total score for how well children are doing, but it also allows us to report reliably on every single one of those 5 domains. So we can actually get into some of the detail around where children's strengths and weaknesses are. So we're going to start off overall with the total learning. What we found was that overall, only 44.7% of these 4 to 5-year-old children enrolled in early learning programs were actually able to do the basic learning tasks that are expected of a child their age and that are needed as they transition into grade R. 27% of children fall into this orange zone, which we're calling falling behind. And these children are going to need support to catch up. 28% are falling in the red zone, which means they're falling far behind and they'll need intensive intervention. Now, the difference between the orange and the red zone really is the degree of developmental delay and the level of intervention that's needed. What we want to see moving forward is more children moving from the orange to the green zone, and we want to make that red zone as small as possible, because it's very, very hard for children in the red zone coming into our education system to be able to cope. The website and our reports that you'll find on the website for Thrive by Five give a lot more detail about each province. And I'm not going to go into each province, we don't have time. But I just wanted to give you a quick glimpse of how what we're seeing here. So in every province, we're seeing children in the red, the orange, and the green. So there's room for improvement everywhere. We see particularly good performance in Western Cape and in Mpumalanga, where over 60% of children are in the green, which is really encouraging. And I think we need to look and see what's going on there. But we see three provinces where roughly only 3 out of 10 children are in the green zone: Free State, KwaZulu-Natal, and Northern Cape. Very high levels of children in that dangerous red zone, something that we need to pay attention to. Now, if we look at each of the learning domains, you can see here that the emergent literacy and language domain is the only domain in which more than 50% of children are on track in the green zone. That is encouraging. But what is of great concern is you'll see fine motor, visual motor integration, only 3 out of 10 children. Now, these skills are really important for children coming into the education system. While children might have the basics for literacy and language, if they don't have fine motor coordination, they're not going to be able to hold a pencil, to copy shapes and letters, to learn to write, which is so essential. And that's, I think, why we start to see children falling back behind when it comes to their reading and writing in later grades. So you can see fine motor, visual motor integration, emergent numeracy and maths, and cognition and executive functioning really need some serious attention. Performance in these learning domains at the point of entry into school is correlated with educational outcomes. So it's going to be extremely difficult for children coming into the education system with deficits in these areas to be able to perform well in and beyond the foundation phase. And what's of great concern as well is we looked at each of these learning domains through an income lens. So we looked at in terms of income quintiles. And we found that there's a high proportion of poor children who are falling far behind in these areas. And these children are really coming into school at a severe disadvantage. Now, we were really interested in understanding this relationship between income and learning outcomes. We didn't have household data on each child, and so we used school quintile data. This was quite rough because we had to allocate a quintile to each early learning program based on the closest school, and we know that that's problematic. So over the next couple of months, we are doing a lot more work to refine the socioeconomic gradient. But what we're already seeing is that there's a strong relationship between children's outcomes at the point of entry into school and the income of the household they're born into. So you can see along the x-axis, quintile one being the poorest children, quintile five being the richest. And as you move from poorer to richer, you see that a child's chances of being on track increase significantly. Now, our national development plan includes a goal to reduce inequality and eliminate income poverty by 2030. If we want to achieve this, reduce inequality, we really have to pay much greater attention to the performance gap between children of different income groups at the point of entry into the schooling system. I'm going to turn now to look at physical growth. So as I said here, we looked at stunting, child's height for age, and we compared it against the World Health Organization standards. What we found was that nationally, 1 in 4 children enrolled in an early learning program showed signs of chronic malnutrition. They were stunted or severely stunted. And you can see that the provincial breakdown, 3 provinces, Eastern Cape, Free State, and Northern Cape, 30% or more of children, so almost 1 in 3 children showing signs of chronic malnutrition. What's really important to note here is that stunting is preventable, but when it does happen, it has severe consequences for the child. At an individual level, it means the child is very unlikely to achieve their full potential. And at a societal level, it has a very detrimental impact on our human capital. We looked at the relationship between a child's height for age, so their stunting scores, and their early learning outcomes. And we found a very strong correlation. So children who showed signs of malnutrition performed worse on the early learning outcomes, which just, again, emphasizes the importance of thinking holistically when we're trying to ensure good educational outcomes. The third area we looked at was social and emotional functioning. So here, as I mentioned, we had a rating scale, and there were two either children met the standard or they didn't meet the standard. So in this area, we just had those two categories. What we found for social relations with peers and adults is that roughly one third of boys and a quarter of girls did not meet the standard. What this means in practice is that these children might struggle as they come into a classroom setting to cooperate with peers. They might turn to aggression to try and resolve problems because they won't have the skills to resolve them in other ways. And they'll struggle to seek support from familiar adults. So this is really something to think about as children are coming into the schooling system to ensure that they have the right social relations in place. The second thing we looked at was emotional readiness for school. And here we found less children to be meeting the standard. And we actually found at provincial level quite a lot of variation with some areas of concern in select provinces. What these children might struggle with is age-appropriate levels of independence. So they might be over-dependent on a grade R teacher as they come into the classroom, which places a burden on him or her. They might struggle to express their needs and feelings and to adjust to change. Like stunting, we also looked at the relationship between social, emotional functioning and learning outcomes and found that this had a very large effect, in fact, a surprisingly large effect, once again, highlighting the importance of thinking holistically when we look at a young child's development. Now, I just want to comment on the difference here between boys and girls. We found this across all domains, except for gross motor development. So generally, boys tended to perform worse than girls. And this isn't something that's unusual. We find that internationally at this age. And some of it can be explained just by the different ways in which young boys and girls develop. But it is something to be mindful of as we're training our practitioners to ensure that they actually encourage boys to participate in activities that will help to develop their full suite of skills. Now, really important to note is that risk tends to be compounded. So what we see is that certain children will face multiple risk factors. And so we looked at that and we found that by the age of 4 years, a child in the lowest income group who is severely stunted is already over 1 year developmentally behind a child of normal growth in the wealthiest quintile when it comes to early learning. Now, at our age, 1 year doesn't make a difference. But when you're four, being 1 year behind is significant. And poor children who are far behind are likely to go into poorer schools who don't have resources for remedial support that's going to be needed. This places an enormous burden on the education system and on teachers that are in that education system and places young children from the poorest quintiles at a massive disadvantage. Now, the good news is this is not irreversible. We know from research that we've done using the same tools, the ELAM tools. We looked at children when they, especially from poor households, as they came into a program, and then we assessed them again as they left the program. And we found that early learning programs can and do make a significant difference to children's development, especially poor children, if the program is of good enough quality. So that's the one thing I just want us to remember, that this is something that we can address. The second thing is that stunting is preventable. It's not an easy thing to fix, but it is preventable. And there are strategies that could be put in place to prevent stunting. And this will mean that more children will be in a position to realize their full potential. The other thing I wanted to mention was that within the data that we collected, we found outliers. We found children from poor households, poor communities that were outperforming their peers. These data outliers are going to be further investigated. We want to understand what are the conditions under which poor children thrive. They thrive despite income poverty. And does that give us some idea about the kinds of things that we could potentially be scaling as interventions? Now, as a portfolio committee, obviously there's an opportunity here and a responsibility to respond to this. And I just wanted to give you some insights into some of the things that are emerging as potential responses. So the first thing is that we must accelerate access to high quality early learning for every child. We have made good progress over the last two decades in increasing the number of children who enrolled in early learning programs. But the poorest children are still excluded. because of funding, and the poorest children still attend poor quality early learning programs because of funding. So the first thing we need to do is we really need to look at funding. Early learning currently gets less than 2% of the annual education budget, and it only reaches 13% of the 5 million poor children who need subsidized programs. If we increase funding and we direct that funding appropriately, we can change outcomes. And this budget, relatively speaking, when you look at it in relation to the bigger education budget, is really small. The second thing is, as DBE takes on this function, there's an opportunity to relook at the regulatory systems. Now, colleagues in the Portfolio Committee, I'm sure in your constituencies, you get frequent complaints about the complexity of registering an early learning program. We have an opportunity here to align these systems to conditions that improve child outcomes. We know now, we have some sense from our data of the kinds of things that are important in improving child outcomes, and those are the things we should be focusing on. The other thing we need to remember, I spoke about the 600,000 children a year coming into grade R without the right foundations in place. We need to think about grade R more effectively as a bridging year. And we need to ensure age-appropriate bands. When a grade R teacher has children aged 3, 4, 5, and 6 in her class, it's very, very difficult. Those children are at very different levels, cognitively and emotionally. We need to make sure that children are at the right age when they come into grade R, and that grade R is designed to effectively bridge those children into the foundation phase. There's also some exciting opportunities for us to think about both ECD practitioner development and curriculum and materials through the lens of these domains. I mentioned, for example, fine motor, visual motor integration as being very poorly developed. Do our ECD practitioners even understand what this means? Do they have the materials in their classrooms to be able to help children to develop those skills? There's some very specific interventions that can be done there. And then, of course, we cannot forget parents. A lot needs to happen in early learning programs, but we also need to engage caregivers and parents as key partners in their child's early development. And finally, if we don't do something about stunting, we are not going to change our educational outcomes at the point of entry into school or at the point of exit into school. We need a nutritional safety net for pregnant women and young children. Now, this index was a baseline. It's the first time this has been done. It provides us with an opportunity to put the flag in the ground. This is where we're at. This is our baseline for 2021. The intention is to repeat data collection on a regular basis, probably every 3 years. And in that way, we can actually track our progress. And in between each of these three-year data collection points, we have the opportunity to really drive action. There are not many things in this country that we can change in 4 years, but this is something. These children have only been alive for 4 years. If they have a different experience in their first 4 years of life, their outcomes will be different. And we no longer have to wait for matric to see if we've made a difference. Because of the index, we'll be able to tell whether we've made a difference at the point of entry into school every 3 years. And we've set up an entity, Data Drive 2030, that's focused specifically on this, partnering with government and other stakeholders to look at how we can practically use data to drive change in early learning outcomes by 2030. Thank you so much.
We can have the next presenter.
Thank you, Sonia, for this exciting and eye-opening presentation. I've seen these results before, but every time I'm still amazed. Thank you for the committee for the opportunity to present the findings of the ECD census. My name is Jan Schenk. I'm the director of Ikape Data, a research company which was responsible for the implementation of the ECD census. And my presentation is divided into two parts. So the first part is about the nuts and bolts of running an ECD census during a pandemic and how we managed to find every ELP in every ward of the country, ELP being our early learning program. And the second part focuses on some of the most important findings that we found from the analysis of the data that we collected. I'm going to share my screen or my presentation just now. So before we went into field, a lot of groundwork had to be done and a lot of preparations needed to be taken care of. And one of those was the development of the data capture instruments. And in fact, we had two instruments. One was an interview or like a questionnaire for the ECD principals. And the other one was a tool for the field workers to complete on their own by purely observing what they could see at the ELPs. So like infrastructure, sanitation, nutrition, those kind of things. We then tested these, and we developed these tools or these instruments together with the stakeholders, including DBE, but also practitioners and sector specialists and experts. We then tested these instruments over a period of 3 weeks in field. So we replicated actual data collection, fieldwork situation as much as possible. So there were actual field workers out there doing interviews with actual ELPs. And after those 3 weeks, we went back to the, not to the drawing board, but to the development of the questionnaires and did some refinements and revisions. And then we recruited around 360 field workers and region coordinators. And when we did so, we prioritized candidates who had a background in working with children, ideally also in the ECD sector. And we also conducted background checks on each one of these candidates. And we didn't, anyone who had a criminal background wasn't allowed to participate in the survey or in the census. And then we trained these candidates at 11 training workshops across the country, each workshop being 3 days long. The reason why it was 11 training workshops partly was because of COVID restrictions, because you could only have up to 50 individuals at each training. Fieldwork was structured by wards. So our approach was that we would make sure that we visit each and every ward in the country. And then in each and every ward, we would not leave that ward until we made sure that we have visited all known early learning programs. So we did have lists of known ELPs before. And that we also made every effort to find new, previously unknown early learning programs in each ward. We spoke to and contacted the DSD district officials in each district and for each ward. We got in touch with the ward councillors in each ward, and we also talked to the ECD networks that were operating in the areas where the ward was located. And in the end, when we looked at the data, and at the very end, we saw that we spent or like we visited each ward on 4 different days on average. And in fact, we visited almost all wards on more than one day. So really went back multiple times to ensuring that we didn't miss anything. In 20% of the ill wards, we actually went back 8 or more days, on 8 or more days. And in order to, that we really try to visit each and every corner of a ward, our field workers were required to capture GPS locations. So we had GPS locations of the ELPs that we captured, but they also had to capture GPS locations and basically in every second corner, street corner, or like in every inhabited area to prove that they've really been there and try to find new ELPs. And at the end of the day, we captured over 240,000 GPS locations.
And you I'm sorry, Mr. Schenk. I think I'm not sure, but I'm getting messages that, well, we can't see the presentation. We only have you.
Okay, let me see what's going on there. yes, my apologies. You should be able to see this now.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
But unfortunately, there were only 2 slides. So this one was the preparation one, which I've been talking about in the beginning. And this was the second one that I've mentioned afterwards, with the 4 average days and then the 240,000 GPS locations. And here you can see a map of the GPS locations that we captured, the red dots being actual ELPs and the more pinkish dots being GPS locations that we captured. So if you zoom in this, in one of these areas, you can see that we really try to cover a lot of area as much as possible to ensure that we don't miss any ELPs. Now, we didn't just rely on driving through wards and hoping to find new ELPs, but we, throughout the census, we made use a lot of avenues to find additional ELPs. So from the beginning, we had access to the Wangasali dataset, which was basically a comprehensive list of known ELPs that were collected just before the census started. And we preloaded this dataset into the tablets of our field workers. They could actually see the locations of these ELPs on a map and on lists, and were able to visit those, what we called known ELPs. We also contacted ECD forums, which were operating nationally or in certain areas. We always made sure to contact local ESD officials who had their own lists of ELPs. We went to primary schools, talked to ward counselors, went to local clinics, which was one of the unexpected but very useful sources of early learning programs. So a lot of clinics had actually their own lists of early learning programs. We spoke to community leaders, such as community members, and there were also radio ads being aired on local radio stations. We also built a WhatsApp bot, so ELP or ESD principals were able to use the bot to find out more about the ESD census or to leave their contact details so we could get in touch with them and find their early learning program in the field. Now, the use of technology was very important for data collection, and we really tried to innovate and made sure that we make the most out of the relatively short period that we had, because data collection was done during the third and fourth COVID wave. And we knew that we basically only had this very narrow window and a very strict deadline set by us by nature. So we employed a lot of technology to work as efficiently as possible. So most or almost all of the data collection happened during that period between end of August and mid of December. And then some mop-ups were done in 2022, in early 2022. So all data capture was done on tablets. The field workers had access to dedicated fieldwork portals, so they could log in with their email address and password and would see the wards and the maps and could do admin. For example, they could track their earnings or could see the personal progress and how many ELPs they've captured through an online fieldwork portal. We had a backend which tracked or worked as a data warehouse and was sending automated messages to field workers as well as quality control staff. And we had an online dashboard for progress tracking and showing preliminary results. We did data checks in real time because data was coming in real time, and the system picked up non-intuitive or just implausible data points automatically and alerted us when necessary. And then we had in place something I mentioned before, the ward completion protocol, which basically meant that before a team was allowed to move on to the next ward, they had to get permission from our office staff who would check the maps and the data for this ward to ensure that they really visited all known places and they have visited all corners of the ward in the search for new ELPs. And only if they got the green light, they were allowed to move on. This is just some screenshots of the tools we are using. So you can see the fieldworker portal, a dashboard, and one of the maps you are using to keep track of progress. this is the most important figure in this presentation. And in total, after data cleaning, we ended up with 42,420 programs that have been counted as part of the census. If you look at this per province, you can see that the figures are in line with population figures for each province. So the largest province in terms of population having the highest number of early learning programs, that being Gauteng, and Northern Cape having a fraction of that number being the smallest province in terms of population. We also looked at quintiles, what Sonia also mentioned in her presentation, basically using the quintile of the closest school to assign a quintile to the programs. And if you look at that, then the distribution per quintile is that about half of the ELPs fall into the two lowest quintiles, about a quarter fall into the highest quintile, and the rest fall into quintile three. If you look at the distribution by urban versus rural, it also follows population statistics, and that around 60% of ELPs are located in urban areas and around 40% in rural areas. Now, this map shows the density of ELPs per number of per children. So the number of ELPs per 1,000 children. If you look at it, you can quickly see that some parts of the Western Cape and the metros have the highest density of ELPs. And this is the kind of analysis which is now possible and wasn't possible before. We can see density distribution. You can use location data and mix it up with the findings from the census itself. And it's quite exciting to have this opportunity now to actually see these very intuitive maps, for example, which give you an insight very quickly and that we weren't able to produce before. Now, these are some of the counts that we did. So we counted a lot of things during our census. And here we counted the enrollment and attendance of children. And enrollment we counted by looking at the actual registers at the ELPs. Attendance, the headcount, we did by actually counting the children which were physically there at the time of our visit. Then for the usual attendance, we asked the practitioners how many children would be there on a usual day, asking whether this headcount represents the actual count, or if maybe on some days they have more children. We also asked what they estimate what the attendance was before COVID, keeping in mind that we did this data collection in the middle of the pandemic. Now, if you look at enrollment, you can see that around 1.7 million children currently enrolled in ELPs. If you look at children being physically there, it's quite a significantly lower number, figure. And I have to keep in mind that there was, as I said, like during the pandemic, so a lot of children weren't attending. It's also, one has to keep in mind that that was a snapshot at the time of the visit of our field workers. So depending on the time of the day, if you were to visit a ELP quite late in the day, some children would have gone home already. So that is I would call it a low estimate of children being physically present at ELPs. So the actual figure is probably somewhere between the headcount and the usual attendance, which is an estimate by the practitioners. One can assume that they maybe overestimate a little bit. But in any case, it's safe to say that the pre-COVID attendance was very likely quite a bit higher and probably lower what is given here also because estimates tend to be on an optimistic side. But it's also very likely that by now, after the fourth wave of COVID, that attendance has risen again a little bit. These are the same figures just being presented as bars. And if you look at those figures, this is a little bit about the, you could see the staff count. So we checked the admin register of staff being employed at ELPs. And so around 200,000 individuals are being employed as in the ECD sector. And if you look at the number of staff per program, it's around 5 individuals. But if you look at, that includes support staff like cleaners and security. If you were to look at teaching staff only, actually ECD practitioners, it's around 4 staff or teaching staff per program, and around 39 children attend a program. But these figures vary quite widely from program to program. Now, some more key findings from we collected a lot of data, and there's a lot more, and the fine report will have much more detail and a lot more graphs. But these are some of the, I think, the relevant findings for this occasion. And one is that around 40%, so 28 plus 12% of ELPs were found to be registered or conditionally registered with Department of Social Development. 16% say they have applied, but they're still waiting for the outcome. And around 42% are not registered with DSD at all. Accordingly, only 33% of ELPs claim that they receive a subsidy from DSD. And consequently, only a minority of ELPs say that they get the primary source of funding from government. And in fact, the great majority, around 70% of ELPs, say that they get their funding through fees. And only a small minority say they get it primarily through donations or fundraising. Now, if you look at staying on the topic of fees, if you look at the average fee amount that ELPs charge parents, it's around 500 Rand. And that's the maximum amount they would charge. So, because some ELPs charge different amounts to different parents. So we asked, like, what is the maximum amount you charge to parents? So that's around 500. But that figure also varies quite significantly between provinces, actually. And you find that on average, children or parents of children pay multiple amounts more of this amount in the Western Cape than, for example, in the Eastern Cape, which is around, I think, below 300 Rand. Well, so this graph shows us the significance of ELPs as providers of nutrition and food to children in the country. So 77% of ECD programs or ELPs claim or say that they provide meals to children. It can be a breakfast or lunch. There's different kinds of meals, but it's quite a large proportion. And half of the ELPs say that also the parents also support that and let provide food for meals. And only 17% say that these meals or meals are coming from government. If you look at the hygiene and water and sanitation at ELPs, you see that 77% of ELPs say they have running water from a tap, which means that 23% don't have access to tap water. And in most cases, water is then coming from a bowl or bucket or tippy tap. Similarly, with toilet facilities, 60% have access to a flush toilet. Those who don't most likely have then a pit latrine, and potties is for the small children. The figures don't add up to 100% because you can have multiple type of toilets and hand washing facilities at our site. But the main takeaway here is that 40% don't have access to a flush toilet. Looking at the qualifications of practitioners, there's some positive findings, at least I would say, that just over half of ECD practitioners have a recognized qualification, ECD qualification, and another 26% or another quarter do have some skills program that is relevant for the work they do. And only 22% say they don't have any relevant training or qualification. Now, we did have a whole section on learning through play, the concept of children being able to learn through play. And we captured the attitudes of ECD practitioners towards the idea of learning through play. And you also asked about how much time they allocate to what we call free play, both for as part of the daily program and part of also of outdoor play. And what we found is that about half in both instances of the ELPs allocate 30 minutes or less to free play. And if you look at these figures per quintile, you'll see that ELPs in higher quintiles actually allocate more time to free play. We also found that 34% of ELPs do not have access to an outdoor playground with suitable equipment, and only 56% have access to age-appropriate books for different age groups. So a higher percentage have access to books and have books on site, but then if you look at if these books are age-appropriate, then that figure drops. And also to illustrate the importance of subsidies maybe, what we did is we had a long list, I think 22 items of materials for learning and play, like educational toys. And the field workers were going through the ELPs and were basically ticking off the things they saw and the items they could find from that list. If you compare the ELPs that are being subsidized by DSD and those which are not subsidized by DSD, that those which are subsidized were three more items from that list compared to those ELPs that are not subsidized. And that's the end of my presentation. I would like to take the opportunity to thank DBE. It's been a very pleasant and productive collaboration. But I would also like to thank the hundreds of field workers which were really working very hard during a very difficult period of time to make that happen. And most importantly, I would like to thank the early learning programs and the practitioners on the ground, but also just community members who helped us and our field workers by giving them advice, showing them around the community, showing them to leading them to ELPs, and which were just giving the time and resources and efforts. It was really a great effort by people who didn't have to help us. And it was very heartwarming to see that unfolding. And yeah, thank you for the opportunity to present this.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much to both of you, Sonia and Jan, for these presentations. I must say, they're very informative. Members, these are the presentations. Maybe I should start it like that. These are the presentation from ECD Census and Thrive by Five. I mean ECD Census, yes. I see a hand of Honorable Sukars, Dr. Tembekwayo, and Resuela. In that order?
Thank you, Chair. I am going to just leave my video off because I'm unfortunately on my phone and I have a little bit of a weak battery. But let me start by first congratulating DBE with this presentation that is really very informative, and thank the researchers for the research and, you know, sharing with us the content thereof that is very eye-opening. It is, for me, really encouraging to see it because of Child Protection Week that we just completed. And in my constituency, we just ran a program on the Cape Flats in Southern Peninsula, focusing on the impact of violence on children. So my question really is around how much efforts are we going to put in, and I'm asking the department, because the integration of poverty, violence, and the impact on children, especially our younger children that are toddlers, and when you look at the presentation now, it would really be so valuable for us to have an integrated approach to look at how, especially young children, the intervention programs that can be initiated at the ground level, specifically in your very hotspot areas where children are exposed to violence daily, and then have the added disadvantages of poverty and its impact on them. So that's the question to the department, and it's a heart cry as well, Chair, because we really see the impact of it as we are in our constituency. Research like this in the best way possible. So I want to just ask the question in terms of the funding mechanisms. What research is going to be done into the best funding mechanism? And I'm going to tie it in again, Chair, because one of the things that we're doing in social development, I think, is we are providing only one of the services of social full basket. And because of that, children, especially that are in your ECDs, that are in your poorer schools, that are grant dependent, are not utilizing the full basket in order for them to holistically develop as into a well-balanced adult. So we the funding mechanism in terms of just having a subsidy is not necessarily the best way. And we are having the conversation around a basic income grant. And so you need to look at all of these things, almost interlinking them, I think. So I just want to know the mix of funding mechanisms, and that one not necessarily assume that subsidies is best, but that we can actually empower parents through funding mechanisms. Then the last question that I just have is, I hope I was clear with that. So it's just around what can we do to strengthen the working on the ground? And I'm talking from us as lawmakers as well as the departments. What are the things that the researchers, as they have worked, think that should be done to strengthen what is available? To ensure that children, and it may be too broad a question, they can just say that, but to ensure that children get the best out of the services that are currently being funded by the taxpayer. They've had this research and done it so well, and they've had worked with ward councillors, they've worked within constituencies, they've worked with children. Just from the research that they've done, what do they see as gaps and that should be filled by all of these different on-the-ground government constituency officers or lawmakers and departments? What can be done better? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you,
Oh, thank you, Chairperson. The following are my questions. In connection with the child development, with a specific reference to chronic malnutrition, the 3 out of 20 who are not on track, they cannot succeed without a significance of intervention. Well, this is a research and its findings. If we go to the actual situation at the centers, how and what type of intervention will be applied, and what are the specific monitoring tools to check the successes and failures thereof? Question 2, gender-based violence do apply to children also. We have had occurrences of children being raped and abused, which greatly affects their development and or learning. Some are even raped at schools. Did your research conducted include inquiry on the GBV-related issues? If it did, can you inform us on the findings? If there were no questions leading to this inquiry, why? Just give us the reasons why, please. And what did you seek to achieve with this research, and specifically referring to the relevance of the research, including the limitations of your research? Because in every research that is conducted, there are always limitations that are supposed to be looked at. What were the ethical considerations that needs to be taken care of, with specific reference to the freedom of participation of the children? How did you address this issue? Who signed the consent forms on behalf of the children? Last question, how did you apply reliability and validity of your research? Should the same research be repeated in 5 years to come? Will the same findings be arrived at? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Zwela.
Chairperson, thank you very much for the opportunity. And also, let me thank the two presenters. It was quite informative. Chair, I have got one or two questions to ask. When the presentation of the enrollments vis-a-vis attendance was made, the numbers varied greatly. For example, it was almost less by 500, or just over 520,000. So based on the statistics of the enrollment and attendance, the head count is 520,000 short of the children enrolled. What were the findings on the causes? As usual, attendance is relatively 200,000 less enrolled. The second question will be, the children who have been lost in the system due to the pandemic, were they largely rural or urban? And what is their distribution using school quintile proximity? With regard to the Thrive presentations, there was mention of age appropriateness. And where it was said that there is difficulty for practitioners to have children, let's say, for example, 3, 4, 5 years of age in the same group, because they are not necessarily on the same level of development. Now, B, that may be the case, and as they find the situations like that, what is it that should be done to ensure that actually these things of age appropriateness is enforced, and in their view, who should enforce it? Is it the department or the school managers? The second question with regard to Thrive will be, what is the relationship between children in early learning fail at 27%, and those falling far behind at 28.3%, with access to facilities and learning materials and training of practitioners. Lastly, what should be the ranking of priorities by the department in distributing its expenditure to firstly improve learning domains in the context of limited fiscal?
He's gone. Mama Shabela?
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Minister and members of the Portfolio Committee. Chair, given the food insecurity and crucial need for nutrition at early childhood centers, it would be interesting to find out what intervention would the government do in terms of providing meals for ELPs, given that government only currently provides 17%. The second question, Chair, according to the presentation, only 27% of ELPs are government funded and almost 70% are fee pay. Again, it would be interesting, Chair, to find out if this has any effect on the learning development of poor learners, should they not be able to afford the average of 509 per month? The last one, Chair, another question would be about the qualifications of ELP practitioners and their effect on the learning development of the learners. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Edwards.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and thank you very much to the two presenters for giving us a very informative and updated presentation on a very important item that we are discussing today of early childhood development, which I heard the minister says this one is very close to her heart. And we have seen that the migration has happened on the 1st of April 2022. So we take it that this information add as an update or even progress made to the migration. I wouldn't say that this is for the first time we receive such information, especially that give us a data mainly on the ECDs. It happened even before migration, where we got very important information that we were actually getting to understand how the migration was going and how the processes were unfolding. So I actually appreciate the information that we receive as and when there's a need for us to, you know, to improve our understanding. Chair, I don't have many questions because for me, these presentations were almost, you know, easy to read and to understand. But just for just to add on some of the questions that members have also asked or alluded to, I would also want to add, you know, mainly on, you know, the coronavirus pandemic has, you know, showed us so many things. We have so many lessons that we have learned, and we had to adjust in doing things that we normally used to do. So I would want to know, we have seen that there was a significant headcount decline in ECD attendance, which is just more than half of those enrolled before COVID. sorry about that. That was done, happened before COVID, which is that now is just more half of those that have also enrolled during this year, 2022. Would want to understand whether is the decline, it was only due to COVID, or is there any other factors that has made the decline to happen. In terms of the ideal ECD sector based on the norms and standards, how many ECDs are supposed to be established? What is the staff count required and average number of children per program and the average staff per program? If maybe I can be clarified on that one. This is on the census, ECD census 2021 presentation. And lastly, on that one, Chair, what is the distribution of qualifications of practitioners without any those with skills program from a rural-urban divide and a quintile proxy point of view? That will be the last question from the first presentation. The second one, Chair, I have only two questions on this second presentation. The first one is with regard to the child standing. The census by the department reflects that 84% of children access breakfast whilst 94% receiving lunch. Therefore, there are relatively high access of nutrition, but the standing level are higher. Is child standing due to ECD condition or food insecurities at the household level? If maybe also one can get an understanding of that challenge, whether it happens at home or is it because the food insecurities that we were experiencing as a country. The last one is, how can the children experiencing physical growth limitations be supported early by the department or government, as this is not limited to ECD challenges, recognizing that the child grant system, which is in existence. Let me pause there, Chair. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. Honorable Adwans, and I think that was the last hand from the members. From my side, I also just a few things to raise. Like I have said that one is commending the type of work that has been done by Thrive by Five. But I must say I'm interested in knowing what then were the benefits for Thrive by Five in terms of rents and stands. And like how much did it cost to undertake this type of a survey? Like one is saying, it's a very informative survey, and you can tell that it is done from the ground. But also, I am interested in understanding your sampling. Did it involve all provinces, or you were just concentrating in some provinces and leaving the others? And with the issue of the ECD books, like you saying that it's 56% of children that
that have access in ELP. Who is publishing the books? Where do you get the publishers of ECD or books? Now, this issue of practitioners that do not have the ECD qualification, I think it's a question also that we've been consistently raising to the department. That was even before the shift took place. Now, your survey is confirming that only 48% of practitioners do have the ECD qualification. Now, what are your recommendations? What are your what do you think needs to be done so that you do not necessarily leave the people who were dealing with this ECD thing, who do not necessarily have a qualifications? What do you think must be done, and it must be done by who? In terms of assisting them so that they are fully qualified? Because the reality of the matter now, you are bringing the ECD to basic education, which everything needs to be quality assured. Everything is professionalized. But that was not the case when they were under social development. So the people who are not qualified, I think they are still a worrying factor from my side. And I think it's a matter that needs to be attended to. There is 33% of Pitla Trans toilets still. And I think all of us, we agree that it is not the situation that we would want to see even if we don't have these little ones, but especially when we have this little one. But I think DBE now needs to really prioritize the issue of these pit latrines. I know not that you are not prioritizing them, you are prioritizing them. But I think something needs to be done with speed now and try to get rid of them, because you cannot have a situation of these pit latrines when you have these smaller nyana kids now that are part of us. Partly the issue of 509 rand per month, which is average, which has been raised by Honorable Mashabela. What, in terms of the households that do not have income at all, because we know there are households who do not have income. There are households now who are depending on this 350 that has been given by government. And there are households who don't even know how to access the 350 and they do not have. But those households do have children. Now, in a situation like that, what needs then to be done to deal with them with such a situation? And then there is about 67%. In one of the slides, there is about 67% of ELPs that are not receiving a subsidy. So what is the plan of the Department of Basic Education to ensure that these subsidies are received by all, not only the 67% that one has referred to, but also 42% of ELPs are not registered and 20% are registered, which is a cause for concern. When are we going to register the rest of ELPs? Because all of them at some point will have to be registered. And what timeline then are we giving ourselves that at a particular period we are going to register all ELPs in the country, and they are going to, we understand also it's a process, but of course there needs to be timelines in a process.
it's a process that has to be, that must have timelines. So those are the issues from my side. From my side, I am not seeing any other hand. And in that case, then I'll give to the minister to lead the responses.
No, thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity. Again, thank members for the engagement. As usual, Chair, I will just answer a few questions, and some of the technical questions we leave to my colleagues, including the Deputy Minister. And I'm equally excited, Chair, when also members appreciate these two reports as extremely important for the new assignment that we have as basic education. We are currently on roadshows with the Deputy Minister, meeting the different role players in the sector, especially your ECD sector itself, your practitioners and owners of ECD institutions, just to first build relationships, develop a common understanding of how we proceed. But they help us also form some basic speaking points. When I'm in these meetings, I use this report of Thrive by Five. And the starting point is, which shows the significance of both reports, that as the education department, we're expected to get our kids to thrive by 10, that by the age of 10, they must read with meaning, with understanding. And we know as educationists that if they don't thrive by 5, it's going to be difficult for them to thrive by 10. And if they don't thrive by 10, we're going to have lots of difficulties to get them to thrive at 15. When they're in the senior phase, we have to prepare them for the FET. That's where we lose them in their numbers. That's where they find it very difficult to cope with your FET phase. So this is very critical for us as a sector, as a country, as a nation, to ensure that we put whatever we can in place to make sure that our kids, indeed, they thrive by 5. UNESCO has run also a study which shows that children at 22 months, if there's no intervention, meaningful intervention in their lives, they'll be in the same position at the age 22. So that thriving by 5 is just very critical. And as I said, those are speaking points that we are using when we engage with communities. And for me, this is also part of the engagement. And we've been getting lots of feedback also from the ECD practitioners on their understanding of the things that are obstacles for our children to thrive by 5. Some of them not necessarily identified in the document, but we're recording them to inform our planning, our curriculum, our teacher development, and agreeing with the sector to say, what are the first things? Is it funding all of you at the same time? Is it when we monitor, what is it that we monitor you? What are the tools that we are going to be agreeing? So those are some of the things that we continuously negotiate, because we had said to the public and the country that this year it will be the status quo, in the sense that we'll fund people the way they were funded, so that there's no disruption, there's smooth transition, but we're going to use the year to plan for the changes that we want. First, as I say, in terms of content, in terms of processes that we're going to go on. The second report also on the audit, Chair, it's also very critical, and it has been very helpful for us, because when the decision was taken that we should take ECD over, I started over also just getting visiting committees to get a sense of what the sector looks like. One example, I went to Deep Slot. It's just one township. On that day, I had more than 103 study centers, which then, as I say, in Deep Slot, we don't have more than 20 schools. Then we have more than 100 ECD centers. So the study in terms of the number of FSEC centers was very helpful also in a sense that confirming that we need to deal with the size and shape of the sector. that there are more than 40,000 centers servicing less than 2 million children. On the other hand, we have 13 million serviced by, maybe you'll say it's not a fair comparison, but it also has to do with our capacity to manage the space. 2 million learners in 40,000 centers. On the other hand, we're having more than 40,000 centers serving less than 3 million learners. Again, it really begins to give us a picture of the size and shape, so that when we talk about the shape and what is going to happen as the future of the sector, we are also scientifically informed. The funding model, I think officials will respond to it. It's going to be informed, as I say, by the size and shape. It's going to be informed also by what we have at hand, and it's also going to be informed by what is a basic thing. What are the bottom lines? Are the bottom lines curriculum, the training of teachers and toys? Are the bottom lines just sorting out nutrition, so that registration should not be necessarily linked to funding? Registration will be expected of everybody. For instance, you don't run a school, whether it's private, whether it's a Crawford, you have to register it with government as an institution and abide by what would have been agreed as norms and standards. So registration, and that's what I've also been telling the centers, to say when you open registration, we're not saying we're going to be registered for funding. So if there's 40,000 of you, if you have registered, then do you think we're going to get a subsidy? No. The registration is going to help you and us to really agree on norms and standards, just as a basic instrument of regulation. And then the funding model is going to be informed by something else, but not necessarily registration. And I think we're developing an understanding with them to say, and which I think, unfortunately, the Thrive by Five was saying the regulation requirements are onerous. We're not sure if they're going to be any easier. And those registration requirements won't necessarily translate to funding obligations, but are going to result in the obligations on norms and standards. So, Chair, these are things what we're talking about this year. We're very active with the Deputy Minister and MECs just to shape the sector quite well, because, as I say, we will never drive by 10. Our kids won't drive by 10 if they don't drive by 5. And they will not drive by 15. If they don't drive by 10. We keep on saying the same stories that we're trying to push the meds, so when you do the following, if they don't drive. International, it shows that kids have to drive by 5 if they have to drive by 10. So let me not repeat myself. But for me, there's excitement about these reports, that they give us scientific basis to deal with the fundamentals, which is the content of ECD, but also the shape and size of ECD and how we proceed, how that informs our planning moving forward. Thank you, Chair. The officials and DM will answer some of the technical problems that have been raised by colleagues around the research methodology. What are the risks? What was the sample? I think that the researchers will be able to respond to that about the funding. As I said, we'll tell you how much we have, and we know that the funding that we have is inadequate in terms of what we need to do. But I always say to people that if you have 10 children, you don't wait for yourself to have 10 bedrooms. You just say, what are the basics that you have to deal with? They have to have a shelter over their heads. They must have spaces, even if they sleep next to each other. As long as some of the basics, they've eaten, they can sleep, they can drink, they can. So, and that's how we're going to approach the matter. We're not going to wait for a situation where we have all the money to deal with the basics and the fundamentals of what we're supposed to do to make sure that our children do indeed thrive by 5. Thank you very much, Chair.
No, thank you, Minister. Anything from you, DM?
Yo, Chair, I think Minister has given the overall. We can allow the officials now to give the flesh, the technical details to this report. Thank you.
All right. That would be Jan and Sonia.
Yeah, Chair, maybe I must first go. Thank you.
Oh, did you? I thought you said right, Limpopo. Okay, fine.
Yes, connectivity is still good here in Limpopo. I agree with the Deputy Minister that the Minister has been extremely comprehensive, responding virtually to everything. Honorable Tembekwayo asked the question as to what is the mischief? What mischief are we trying to deal with from these two research topics? But the minister responded comprehensively to that to say, one, we've taken ECD lock, stock and barrel, footstool. In a way, Chairperson, we are empowering the portfolio committee. As we report to the portfolio committee an update on carrying out our mandate on ECD to be able to say, have you attended to this? Have you attended to this? Informed by empirical undertaking. The two colleagues are researchers who are not even based in DBE. The Honorable Sukers, no wonder that she appreciates this. Almost in every meeting, she would say to us, what research have you conducted? As she believes, the minister believes that our approach must be evidence-based and must be informed by empirical undertaking. And that's the value and the basis of this research. In other words, when we go to Treasury, when we engage with provinces, we'll be guided by empirical data. Provinces received this at HEDCOM on Monday. They even requested that they want dedicated sessions with themselves delving into individual provinces' situation, because they are also woefully aware that they need to get themselves ready for a new delivery model that the minister talked about. What is going to inform the new delivery models are this findings from the empirical undertaking that has been made by the researchers. Before I just conclude, I think the minister also indicated that the ECD centers are at various levels, whether you're talking subsidy, and minister is right, even with schools, the state is not under any obligation to subsidize all of them. There are other imperatives that informs subsidy. And you don't have to subsidize all, because some don't actually even need subsidy. They are better off without subsidy. And subsidy also has got its own constraints, because you've got to meet certain conditions for you to be able to get subsidy, which is a requirement. So they are at different levels of even the qualification of practitioners. Honorable Mashabela, some practitioners, are NQF level 5, some are NQF level 6, some have even gone beyond NQF level 6. Some are even below NQF level 4, below grade 12. So it's a big stew pot. And you are saying from an empirical data point of view, what is going to inform better our human resource development strategy to make sure that we bring everybody more or less on par. And I'll just conclude by highlighting the importance of that. What is also good is that we now have, and I think Honorable Suker raised this one, the integrated ECD program approved by Cabinet a while ago. Now we need to revisit that integrated program for ECD, which is led by basic education, social development, Department of Health, and of course, bringing other departments such as public works, And Honorable Suker raised the issue of violence, gender-based violence, bringing the Department of SAPS or community safety to address issues of safety and so on, to deal with issues of violence. So we need to revisit that to make sure that the program reflects of different roles of all those line departments to be brought to bear so that the holistic development of the child is fully realized and addressed through the implementation of the program. As I learned, the last point, all over the world, what informs quality of education are five variables. If we talk about quality of education, and the minister touched on some of them. The first one is the curriculum. We now have the National Curriculum Framework for ECD for 0 to 4 year old, including grade R. There's no problem about that. What becomes key is to make sure that every ECD center implements the NCF, the National Curriculum Framework, throughout, because it outlines clearly the skills and competencies that are to be acquired at different levels of development of those different age categories of learners. The second issue to the curriculum is the practitioners or the teachers, if you like. That's variable number two all over the world. And Honorable Mashabela raised the issue of the qualification, which is very key. And that's why we need, in our new delivery model, we cannot escape to plan for this as well. In terms of making sure that practitioners are brought on par, the new entrants into the system, we say, here are the minimum requirements going forward. And of course, the third one is the one that has been touched by Honorable Aduns and the Chair, is around LTSM. What kind of learning and teaching support material is provided? Because it's a quality driver as well, which is very important. So we'll definitely have to look at that. And of course, the next one is around assessment, which is linked to the curriculum. Unfortunately, I've forgotten the last one. I've talked about the curriculum. I've talked about the practitioners. I've talked about LTSM. I've talked about assessment. I've just forgotten the fifth one. Those are the five things that actually inform quality. If you say you're providing quality ECD program, you're providing quality education, it must be predicated on those five variables that will determine whether you're providing quality or not. Maybe we could then, Chair, request Sonia and Jan to come in, and Dr. Whittle and the team could also fill in where we've not responded to. Otherwise, thank you very much, Chair, for the privilege.
Thank you, DG. Sonia, Jan?
Thank you, everyone, for a really comprehensive set of questions. I'll tackle some of them, and then I'll hand over to Jan, if that's okay. So I've noted that there were a few questions about the research, the methodology, the ethics. So I thought I'll start with those first, tackle those questions first. So the first to say is that We did this research in every single province. The number of children in the final sample ranged between 540 and 600 children per province. So they were all represented, and we looked as well at the proportional representativity in terms of quintile representation in provinces. The cost was around, there was some COVID-related additional costs, but it was about 12 million to undertake this work. I also just want to note that ICAPA Data, the organization that Jan's representing, was critical to this. They were involved
involved in this data collection as well. So they really are a critical stakeholder in the field. And we're very grateful for their excellent work. The limitations, very good question. There are a number of limitations. These are detailed in the technical report, but I'll just mention a few. The first is during COVID. So we don't know. I mean, the children were wearing, we had these plastic shield masks, and obviously the assessors were all masked. There was a lot of sanitizing. We don't know to what extent that would have affected the children. That's something we really need to take into account. We obviously try to minimize disruption, but that is a rather strange situation. The other thing is, as I mentioned, the allocation of quintiles, it's not very accurate. And so we're doing some more work to look at the income levels more accurately of the children attending the early learning program so that we can refine that. The also thing that, the fact that the census and the index data collection was happening at the same time sometimes caused a little bit of confusion in the field amongst early learning program principals. So that had to be addressed. So there were these sorts of limitations, but nothing significant that we feel in any way undermines the quality or the validity of the findings. And more information on that is available in the technical report. Now, when it comes to ethical considerations, we went through a process where we distributed, before we went into the field, we obviously had contacted all the principals of each site, had conversations with them. We sent a form to them in advance, which they then sent home to parents, which was really asking parents if there were any objections. Obviously, if there are any objections, those children aren't included. And then on the day, we only selected from children whose parents hadn't lodged any objections. And then the children themselves are also given the opportunity to opt out at any stage. And obviously, they're very little, so it's hard for them. But we have, these check-ins that are built in to make sure that the child is comfortable and okay. And if the child doesn't answer a question or is really struggling, the assessment is automatically stopped. So I think that's just to answer that question around ethical considerations. Then in terms of gender-based violence, so no, we didn't look at that. I mean, I think violence in general against young children is of great concern. And I think that, it may be why we're seeing in certain provinces high rates of children who are socially and emotionally not meeting standard. It may be linked to that. We obviously don't know, but we didn't specifically look at that. I think when you're looking at a topic like that, it requires a different kind of methodology. So this was a survey methodology, it was training people that had a week's training, I think, to be able to go out and do these assessments. I think if you're doing research around things like gender-based violence, you really are needing a different type of field worker or researcher. So we didn't include that. On the reliability and the validity, so firstly, just to come to the point that DG made around the national curriculum framework. So the tools that we used were developed in 2016, and part of the process of developing it was aligning it to the national curriculum framework to make sure that we were actually really looking at the things that children should be able to do. We also did interviews with grade R practitioners to understand the skills that children needed, looked at international research. It was an extensive process, and then meetings were held with Department of Basic Education, Umalusi, researchers, Department of Social Development, others, to really agree on what does it mean to be on track? What does it mean to be falling behind? And what does it mean to be falling far behind? So that whole process happened over a couple of years to be able to make sure that these tools actually provide a reliable measure. There was also extensive process to ensure that that it was fair. In other words, that none of the items in any way disadvantage children who might live in rural areas or who might be in more impoverished home circumstances. And then also we did an extensive process to ensure that it was also that there was interlanguage reliability, so that the items, if we assess children about ask children to name an item, that word wasn't a lot more difficult in a different language, so that there was language equivalent. So there really was a process, and there's a full technical manual speaking about that if anyone is interested on that. So I think that's just something to point out around the reliability and the validity. And then in terms of the data collection itself, assessors were required to follow a very, very explicit protocol. So they had to they had to do things. There was a lot of fidelity in the implementation. So they had to ask things in exactly the same way. They had to follow exactly the same protocol. It's all scripted to make sure that it's fair and that it's replicable, so that you can actually repeat it over time. So I think that covers the questions around the research itself. Then there was a question around monitoring of quality. And I know there's a whole nother process that DBE is involved in with some other organizations that's looking at quality assurance. And we really, we fed all of this information into that process. So how do you use this data to monitor the quality of early learning programs? And there's a process underway, which I'm sure colleagues from the Department of Basic Education could elaborate on, that really is looking at a quality assurance system. The other question was around the relationship between these different things, and different people asked that in different ways. So I'm just going to sort of pull it all together. So we've got another set of data that we're busy analyzing at the moment, which is similar to the census, but we asked the same questions as the census, plus a whole lot more. Plus we spent 2 hours actually observing the quality of programs. And so we've got a whole nother set of data that describes what is going on in about 500 programs. And it's the same programs that we've got child outcomes data for. So what this, we now combining these two and saying, okay, we know what child outcomes look like in these sites, and we know what these sites were like. We know, we've asked questions around qualifications. We've looked at things like fees. We've looked at salaries being paid, learning materials, the quality of the interactions, the menu, everything. So now we're analyzing these two together to see what is the relationship between the different characteristics of a program and child outcomes. And that is, we're adding that to other data that we have. And then we'll very happy to come back and present to say, these are the factors that we can see are associated with improved outcomes. And these are the ones that are less important. Now, one of the things that we've seen already from other research that we've done is the quality of the practitioner, the quality of the teaching, the interaction between the child and the teacher is the most important thing. It is so important. But whether or not the practitioner is actually qualified at this point doesn't make the biggest difference. The biggest difference is whether the practitioner is mentored, is supported, and is able to implement what they've learned within a classroom setting. So the reason I'm saying that is qualifications are important, but it's not the panacea. Having qualified practitioners who aren't supported and mentored and actually helped to implement what they learn in the classroom means that the qualification won't make a difference in child outcomes. So I think that's something we must just think about carefully, that there's a package of support for early learning practitioners. Then another question was around stunting, and there was a good question around the fact that, we do provide child support grant now, we do have nutritional programs, but we're still seeing high rates of stunting. Now, the nutritional programs are really important because they make sure that children aren't hungry so they can learn in that moment. But stunting actually, the actual physical, stunting happens earlier on. So in order to address stunting, we need to make sure that mothers have healthy pregnancies and that the child has good nutrition, especially in the first 2 years of life. And what happens with the child support grant is very often, because of the application process, children only end up benefiting from the child support grant in their second year, because it often takes the mother or the caregiver the first year to get all the documents, to do the application process. And so there's a delay in uptake. And it's that first year when the child most needs access. So one of the things that we've put forward as a recommendation, and others have been advocating for this, is that the grant starts during maternity period. So actually during pregnancy, the pregnant mother is helped to access a grant, which ensures that she has better nutrition, and which means that when the child is born, a child is already on a grant and it would just need verification of the birth. So I think that's one important thing, is we need to have interventions earlier. And stunting also, unfortunately, has other things like access to clean water and adequate healthcare, which obviously also need to be taken into account. But feeding in early learning programs and in schools play a critical role well. And we do know from research that's been done elsewhere that good nutrition can turn it around, turn stunting around to some extent. So you can actually see that children who are stunted, when they get adequate nutrition a little bit later on, it actually can remedy some of the effects of early malnutrition. In terms of numbers of children and staff per program, so there was a question around that, and Jan can add to it. There are norms and standards which speak to that. It varies by the age of the child. So it's different. There's different ratios depending on the age of the child. So I think it's 1 to 6 for children under 18 months. And then it goes up to 1 to 20 for children age 4 to 5, for example. So there definitely are those norms and standards. And it would be interesting to really, break the census data up into sort of more granular sizes so that we can see how those ratios are actually playing out when we look at ages of different children. And then finally, I just wanted to speak to the age appropriateness. So I mentioned about being careful about having a wide range of age bands in grade R. Now, within an early learning program, you know, some early learning programs might only have, you know, they might be in an area where it might be quite remote. And so they provide care to children from 2 years to 5 years or from birth to 5 years. And they're all mixed up in one group. And that's okay in that context if it's a small group of children in that situation. I was specifically referring to grade R, where because grade R is free and early learning programs often aren't, parents will send their child to grade R too early. They'll send their child as soon as the principal of that school is willing to accept their child, they'll send their child. And if we don't provide more funding to ensure free access to early learning programs, then that's going to keep happening. People are going to keep sending their children too young to grade R. And at the end of the day, it doesn't benefit the child and it places a big burden on that teacher and children end up having to repeat. And I'm sure this is played out in the DBE statistics. So that was just the caution around really thinking about that. And that obviously would be something that would need to be enforced by the department. I'm going to stop there and hand over to Jan, and I'm really happy to pick up on any questions I may have missed.
Thank you, Sonia. So I'm going to dive right into the questions. And I think the first one was actually quite a general question about our experience in the field and having observed the sector quite closely, and just some thoughts around what can be done to improve access to early childhood development and to improve the sector in general. Now, I'm probably going to answer this question from a very administrative point of view or technical point of view. And just maybe from my own and my team's experience, having done this research and field work, I think the most important, or like one of the most important steps have been now done by collecting this data for the ECD census, because the lack of simply a list of early childhood development programs that didn't exist before, I think was a huge barrier to make any meaningful progress and implement changes. And just to illustrate that, when we started this, I was personally surprised to realize that even there wasn't even a list of early learning programs or consolidated list and definite list of early learning programs subsidized by DSD. Basically, each district had their own list, and the quality of these lists were of variable quality. And it was only the Mangasari data set which combined these lists in a way, but because of the quality of the source lists, that information was also spotty. So a lot of times, for example, basics like contact numbers or addresses are just missing. So for the first time to have that really comprehensive and complete list of early learning programs, I think is a basic requirement and necessity to do anything really. But the next step, I think, is also something that DBE is now actively working on already, which is turning this list into a management information system similar to the existing EMIS database of schools. And I think that's an absolutely necessary step, because what we have experienced, even doing fieldwork, is this is a very dynamic sector. So early learning programs pop up and shut down on a daily basis. So in a sense, the census list was outdated on the day it was completed. In fact, we tried to go back to some of the early learning programs that we collected at the beginning of data collection, only to find that they have closed down already. And some of the early learning programs that we collected towards the, or captured towards the end of data collection, didn't even exist at the time that we started the data collection in August. So just to illustrate that how dynamic the sector is. And I think that's going to be a very interesting challenge to capture and to maintain this list and database of programs. And I think it will require a lot of innovation and out of the box thinking in how to achieve that, because it's not, I imagine it's quite difficult already to keep track, for example, of around 60,000 schools. But if you think about it, schools are relatively, compared to early learning programs, relatively easy to identify and keeping track of. And it's not easy, but it's easier than early learning programs. Now you have more than double, almost triple number of early learning programs, some of them really tiny, very informal. And I think one has to think about how to make it possible for these early learning programs to self-maintain also their database entry, or like their registration. And that can maybe be achieved through incentivizing that. So if you, and that's just thinking off top of my head, or like I don't want to make any grand suggestions, but if you would bind your maintenance of your information on a database to your subsidy, so every 3 months or something you have to update your contact details, for example, then I think it would go a long way to keep that database up to date. And I think it will be crucial for a lot of the interventions that are required to have that list maintained. Another thing, basically from our outsider's perspective a little bit, when we started this, actually the difficulty to become registered as an ELP was something that struck me. And that's, I think, also different from region to region, basically from district to district. I just realized that how much hinges at the moment on the capacity of the local district DSD offices to process applications and follow up on and supporting early learning programs. So in a well-run district, things can go quite smoothly, but in other districts, it looks so different. And I think that unevenness is, I would think, is something that needs to be addressed. And then just thinking about the scale of this challenge, maybe it's also important to have a certain level of realistic expectations. I'm not sure if it's actually possible to have each and every child being enrolled in a early childhood development institution. And I'm aware of, for example, of a lot of initiatives going on, not some initiatives going on in the moment to improve the capacity of parents to teach their children or play with them in a way that supports their development. And I think, yes, we definitely one needs to extend the access to early childhood development in an institutional sense, but also think about home-based, and not forget about home-based early childhood development. In terms of how to monitor progress, now both initiatives, I think the ECD Census and the Thrive by Five Index, are very important starting points and initiatives to get that going. And again, having just a list of places one can actually use for evaluation and doing research is just a basic requirement. Just to previous to the census, when we were doing survey work in the ECD sector, just not having a sampling frame, to use a research term, and something that's quite important to meaningful research, was a huge problem. Like you never knew whether your findings were representative of anything really. And maintaining that list, as I also mentioned, is important, but then also using the tools which are available. So Data Drive 2030, which is spearheaded by Sonia, makes tools available for free to implement this, implement monitoring and evaluation initiatives. And so it's important to use it. And it needs a standardized tool. So I think it's important to make more use of it. And maybe, again, link it to, not leave it to stakeholders from the private sector or from social sector to implement it, but actually from government to drive monitoring on-site at early learning programs and push for more research from driven by government actually. In terms of gender-based violence and how that whether that was addressed in our research, the short answer is not really. And one reason is that for the ECD census, the data collection was really at the early learning, the program level. So we didn't engage with children at all purposefully, because it would have required different ethical clearance, and we would have had to talk to the parents and get their permission. Simply wasn't feasible on that level. So the data collection for the census was a relatively top level, not going into children level detailed data collection. So you don't really have data on gender-based violence through the census. One might be able to use some of the variables we collected. For example, for sanitation, we did ask about whether they have separate toilets. So it might be possible to use some of this data for some of the other studies or for follow-up studies, but we didn't per se. In terms of limitations of the study, or the census, now we're very confident that we really captured the very, like as many can capture through this kind of exercise, but it would be unrealistic to expect that we really captured each and every ELP that existed during the time that we collected data. And if I had to pinpoint maybe two types of early learning programs where it was difficult and the most challenging to capture those, then I would mention really small and informal ones. So we did try to collect day mothers as much as possible, and day mothers being single practitioner with up to six children, which operating often in a very informal and like at people's homes. And it's just, I mean, it's, one doesn't need much imagination to see why that's difficult, because you can walk past the house and not know that there's actually a group of four children being looked after. And we had to rely on community members to point this out to us. And so that's just will always be a challenge to capture these really tiny learning programs. And then a bit on the other end of the spectrum, it's actually quite difficult to, maybe not to find them, but to get access to early learning programs which are based at high LSM private schools. So the really fancy schools, they're not overly keen to let researchers in. It requires a lot more work to get permission, and sometimes you just don't get the permission at all. One can also mention why that is. And it's, that's a research challenge in, not only for early learning, early child development, but for school-based research in general, and in fact for research of any kind, the survey-based research in South Africa, the most difficult places to get in are the rich places, to make it short. But it's not to, but these limitations are not enough to question the reliability of the census. And 42,000 programs, it's, I think the number kind of speaks for itself. It is, was, even if some of, we missed some early learning programs, the results you draw from the insights you draw from the ones we did collect, because the sheer number of, if you like, of your sample size is enough to rule out any, great, marginal errors. In terms of ethical considerations, so because we didn't, speak to German, to children, and in fact, we instructed, the field workers instructed to stay away from the children as much as possible. We didn't have to obtain parental consent. We did, of course, did consent from the people that we talked to, the principals, so they could refuse to pay. Some did refuse to talk to us and also didn't let us into the early learning program. We still included the programs that we visited and we didn't have access to. But the overall response rate was actually around 95%. I was one question about the cause for this discrepancy between enrollment and attendance. And I think it is a very important not finding and a very important thing to think about. I can't give a definite cause for this discrepancy. There are certain factors which certainly played into that, COVID being probably the most important one. So just imagine that like these early learning programs would have their attendance register from which would span from a time period before COVID or like before the previous wave, and then you go there just after the wave three, and a lot of children or their parents are still hesitant to let their children go to early learning program. So there's definitely that's a big factor. Another one is important to keep in mind that in attendance was captured as a count at the time of the visit of the field workers. So if a field worker would arrive at an early learning program, let's say at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you would get a different headcount than what you would get, let's say at 10 o'clock in the morning. So that some of the discrepancy is based on that. And, I think more analysis needs to be done on the existing data to try to tweak out those COVID and, time of, attendance factors. So one would be able to maybe see a different, a trend to less children being counted towards late in the day, and then draw inferences which allow you to kind of supplement, and impute, values for attendance. But I think at the end of the day, it is an important finding that there is indeed a discrepancy between enrollment and attendance. So studies which don't take that into account, only take enrollment, might be over counting and making assumptions about number of children at programs, which might affect the findings. So I think it's something which is indeed not being acknowledged enough yet in research in the early childhood development. There was also a question about whether one could draw inferences about urban-rural differences and how many children didn't attend programs during COVID. I think the data would actually be able to give you an answer to that. I don't have the analysis for that at hand. But I think I would like to point out, and something I forgot to mention, the data set will be made available publicly through Data First at University of Cape Town. We're in the process of anonymizing the data set. And then researchers or anyone really will be able to download the data set and make those kind of specific analyses. Now, for the report that was presented today, we really just had to focus on the top level findings, simply because there's so many variables in there, and you could write multiple PhD theses on using the data, and we had to restrict it in some way. Also, to clarify the average staff per program. So on average, we found that a program had 5 staff per program, but it included support staff. And if you look at only teaching staff, then it's around 4 staff per program. But that varies a lot between rural quintiles and provinces. So it will be really interesting to look at this data and much more fine-grained. Again, it's not something we were able to do in this for the purpose of this report, but once the data is being published, anybody will be able to look at it in more detail. And the answer is basically the same one for looking at qualifications per quintile or rural. Now, there was a question about the books and the publishers of books. So we didn't look at it in such detail. So we asked multiple questions about the type of books being available, but we don't have that level of detail in terms of who what kind of books or what is the publishers of books. But I would like to point to a separate study which is being initiated by the Legal Foundation just now, which is going to be a deep dive into the ECD sector and really trying to understand what makes some early learning programs work better than other programs. And I'm pretty sure that that sort of question will also be addressed during that study. So it will be quite interesting to see the results of the study by the end of the year. In terms of ECD qualifications, now, I'm not an expert on that, so I don't want to speculate too much. But it's, again, I think just formalizing and professionalizing the sector as a whole and increasing registration and maintaining that list of early learning programs and having an actual system to manage to these different programs, I think it's just a basic requirement also for professionalizing and making qualifications and enforcing qualifications in the sector. I would imagine that this could be done in collaboration with sector stakeholders, as it is happening already. There are certain organizations and communities which are supporting ECD practitioners in obtaining the relevant qualifications. Other questions around, like, for example, the observations around availability of toilets or how many ELPs receiving subsidies. Again, I think the basic requirement to improve on this and is really to have that database that exists now, but maintaining it over time and making sure that it's not just a one snapshot in time and then having to redo the whole exercise maybe every 10 years. Instead, really having a live database. I'm just being reminded by working with the data from it was an audit in 2014, which captured, was basically previously the biggest or most comprehensive list of early learning programs, which had 16,000. And that list basically just was never updated. And still, even in 2020, we were trying to work with it listed, which had programs which were captured 7 years prior. And one can just imagine how accurate or inaccurate that list becomes over time. So, yeah, for any improvements on a logistical or structural level, one needs this basic requirement, which is this database that I've been mentioning. And I think, yeah, these are the questions that I captured, but I'm happy to answer any questions I might have forgotten.
Thank you so much, Sonia and Jan. I see there is a follow-up from Honorable Sukers.
Thank you, Chair. My follow-up is just, I want to appreciate what the last presenter has emphasized or said, rather than emphasized, that it is obvious that, you know, it's not every, we can't institutionalize, only look at institutionalizing the ECD sector. We need to be cognizant of the fact that there is a large proportion of parents by choice who would want to educate their children at home. And also we need to face the reality in terms of that, by my assessment, it is still, if there is capability and an enabled parent, one of the most successful ways, you know, to develop children and teach children is certainly when they have that at home. So I just, my follow-ups are, once the Bella Bill is adopted, how many children in ECD will be subjected to compulsory education, and what percentage will stay at home, become home educators, and how will they be supported? And will this research database be available to other researchers? Those are just the three questions I have as a follow-up, Jay.
All right. Thank you very much, Honorable Sukers. I think also, Ian, if you can probably when the link, when the data is published, can we also have the link as the committee? Because I think we would be very much interested in that. And to Sonia, I'm not sure whether it's me who is not really getting your answer clearly in terms of the qualifications for the practitioners. I'm not sure if I heard you clearly when you said that is not important at this stage, and my follow up would be, if not at this stage, then when would we see that practitioners needs to have qualifications? And also from yourself, can you share with our secretary the monitoring tools that you have referred to? Yeah, I don't see any other hand. Probably you can respond to that, and then we move towards closure.
Yes, thank you so much for clarifying. I'm really glad you did, because that's not, I'm hoping I didn't give that impression. So as Jan said, I mean, generally professionalizing the sector is critically important. I think even, you know, the minister was saying on her roadshow, you know, recognizing, meeting with early learning programs and recognizing that, you know, to thrive by 15 or 10, you have to thrive by 5. And that already just means that we're seeing people who are working hard in the space, that we're recognizing the importance of their work. And I think that's a big step forward, that early learning practitioners feel like they're seen and heard and that they're recognized. And further to that, training, qualifications, professionalization, it's all part of the process. What I was simply saying was that we've looked at, you know, we've done research to look at whether being qualified means that you get better child outcomes. If the child is in a classroom with a qualified practitioner, is there better child outcome? And the answer is no. On its own, simply having a qualification doesn't lead automatically to improved outcomes. We need to ensure that there's also support and mentoring for practitioners, because they'll learn things in a qualification in theory. And then if they don't have the right support, it's very hard. It's the same as in any sort of teaching environment. It's very hard to implement that in practice. And so what we want is to see qualifications going hand in hand with on-site mentoring and support. And then we will, I think we will see the learning outcomes that we wanted to change. So I hope that clarifies. I don't want to give the impression that we shouldn't be professionalizing. And the other thing I just wanted to say is, you know, this is very different from the rest of the schooling system, in that it's almost entirely delivered by entrepreneurs who are operating outside of the state sector. And so the role of the state here is different from the role it plays in the sort of primary and secondary education. And I think that's also something to think about. You know, there are amazing entrepreneurial women out there and men who've set up early learning programs and are doing an incredible job. And I think we need to look at how best to support them, ensure professionalization and registration and funding to support them to continue to deliver their work. And I think that's something as well just to be thinking about. And then just to say that I'll share the data for the index is also, like Jan said, it's also going to be going open access on the Data First website at UCT, and we'll be encouraging other researchers to engage with it. I'll share the link to that once it's loaded, and I'll share the link to the Thrive by Five website where you can also access the technical reports and information on the data tools. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan.
Yeah, from my side, I think not much to add. I also can only say that the data set will be made available through the Data First website, so you will be able to exit it that way. I know that Data First requires registration, so one would have to provide their email address, but then you are giving a password, and then you can download the entire data set. But I'm sure that there will be ways to share the data set, the final data set, with this committee, of course, and other ways. And I imagine I will be in touch with the good people at DBE to make that happen. So I'm not sure if I missed anything else.
No, I think you have covered. Thank you very much, Minister, DM, DG, and DBE officials, Sonia, Tanya, Sonia and Jan. Thank you very much to all of you. We are now releasing you so that we deal with our committee issues. Thank you very much for this presentation. I think it has opened us more. It has made us cleverer than we were yesterday. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thanks to the committee.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Llewellyn, can you fight the minutes? Members, we've got the minutes of the meeting that we had last week, where we were having a briefing on the Northern Cape, Western Cape and Free State, on the recommendations we had on the oversight. Page one is the attendance, and page two and page three. On page four, we have opened the meeting where we have welcomed Northern Cape, Free State, and Western Cape. And then the DM has thanked us, and they have presented that the Western Cape has made late submissions. And then we have noted the late submission of the Western Cape, which was the similar incident like that of the Free State. And then we have resolved to retain them and give them a new date. After that, we had a presentation then from the Free State, which was led by the MEC of Free State, Dr. Tate Makwe. And then we also had a presentation by Northern Cape, which was led by MEC Zolile Monakali. And both the presentation had responded on our recommendations. And then here we've got our observations and questions. And and then we had responses from Free State. And then Northern Cape as well. They gave us the responses. And then the meeting at concluded where we had thanked everybody that was in the meeting. And then we have requested members to note the changes of the agenda that is for this week. And also the fact that we had an invitation of the joint meeting with Higher Education, Science and Innovation. And then the secretariat was tasked to identify communication of the new dates for the Western Cape so that we can finish our oversight recommendation. And then we have adopted the minutes of the 24th of May, which were moved by Honorable Morwatsetla and seconded by Honorable van der Walt. And then we had adjourned our meeting at 12:36. Any corrections? In the absence of corrections, can we adopt then the minutes?
My unconspicuous hand is up. I want to rise to move that we adopt this minutes as a true record of what transpired on that day in question.
Thank you very much. Any seconder?
Chairperson, I second.
Thank you very much, Rosuela. Thank you very much, honorable members. And now, at this point, I think we just need to deal with a few issues. One is that tomorrow, like we have said in the minutes, we are supposed to have a joint meeting with Higher Education. But I don't know how members would handle it, because I think the issue of their documents, they came late and like we have expected. So I don't know whether members would be of the view that we just communicate with them and postpone for probably the next available date. I'll just allow members to speak on this matter. Honorable Morwatsetla.
Modula Stulo, thank you for the opportunity. I hear you talking about the presentation from the Department of Higher Education. I've not yet seen it. And I believe if you might have been privy to have it as the chair, it is likely might have been delivered today. We have set a precedence in this portfolio committee on basic education that we are not going to entertain any such presentation which is forwarded to us late. Let me just use the word late. Because
by implication, our researchers shall not have interacted with it. And we also shall have not interacted with it. So what is the use of taking the members to a portfolio committee meeting or a meeting when the document has not fully been interacted with? And for this reason, and with this background, I want to kindly propose, Chairperson, that the meeting with the Department of Higher Education be postponed until further notice, until such a time that we shall have convinced ourselves that we have seen their presentations, we have interacted with it, so that our contributions in such a meeting be well informed. Thank you very much, my chair.
Thank you, Principal. Dr. Tembekwaya?
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to also agree to the sentiments that were expressed by Honorable Muratsetla to say, let it be postponed to a later date due to the facts that were mentioned by him. Thank you.
Okay, agreed then. Our meeting is going to be postponed till further notice. We are going to notify members of the new date. So members must just take note, we have deferred two meetings, which is now Higher Education and the Western Cape presentations. So those meetings then we must just know that we have deferred two meetings. And then the next issue is the next week, we are going to have, next week actually is the last week before we go on recess. So our meeting is on Tuesday, which is the 14th, which is our normal meeting. Now, members, we are going to have our meeting on Tuesday, but at 6 o'clock. Not at 9:30. Reasons for that is there are plenaries in the National Assembly next week. I think it's because of it's the last week. All plenaries are starting at 10 from Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So we can't have then a meeting at 9:30. For that reason, we are going to have a meeting at 1800 hours. So our members should take note of that. The other issue is that as we are going for a recess next week, members would remember that the closure for submission for Bella Bill is the 15th of June, which is a day after our committee meeting. Now, I would propose that members must expect that we'll probably have a special meeting that week, where even if it's Friday, after the closure of the submissions, so that we just discuss a way forward. And why I'm raising this, we have received many letters in my office that are asking for extension from many stakeholders, which I think when we deal with the matter, we can read those letters, or we will email them actually when we have decided on a date, for everybody to see the letters that we have received for extension. But also I think it will give us an opportunity to see how many submissions have we received, so that we are able to agree whether it's going to be a meeting, whether we agree to put an extension, or we see how do we move forward after the extension, because we can't wait then because we're only coming back in August. After next week, early August. So members then should bear with us. I'm just alerting members, we would probably call for a very special and urgent portfolio committee next week.
just after the 15th, so that we see how are we going to deal with the issues of the Bella Bill submissions. And the last issue from my side is the Mpumalanga oversight. When we come back, the first week of, when we come back in August, that first week we must do the Mpumalanga oversight. I know, Llewellyn, them, you are done with the identification of districts and the schools that we need to visit. We just need to revise that. We revive it. Next week when we finish, we are just going to go through that program so that we allow you to make the necessary arrangements for members to partake in that oversight that will be in Mpumalanga. So those are the issues from my side. Honorable Adwans, your hand is up.
Oh, okay. No, thanks, Chair. Actually, I did not raise my hand, but maybe it's a legacy one. But I fully agree with you that we must go to oversight or to recess, having met to discuss those issues. Thank you, Chair.
Oh, but your hand was up then. Okay, members, so those are the three issues that I wanted to raise. I'm not sure if members have anything to say on them.
Surely, Chairperson, my hand is up. When you speak and present to honorable members of this portfolio committee. And I want to say officially and formally support that, especially on the first one that you raised, that it is important for us to meet on or be basically before the 15th, the closing date, so that we have got an informed position and then a structural and informed position to avoid any form of dispute, to say, but this is the position of the portfolio committee. We need to formalize it, and hence I will support you for that. With regard to Mpumalanga, this is long overdue, and the sooner we activate this, the better. Thank you very much.
Okay. Then on that note, then we agree on the way forward. We are going to meet then next week, Tuesday at 6 o'clock. Probably by then. Of course, we must have the Mpumalanga program so that it can be adopted by the committee for you to work on it, Llewellyn and the team, the bookings and so on. And then the issue of submissions, like I've said, we are going to have a meeting which is not necessarily the one of the 14th, but after the 15th, after the closing date. We are going to have that that meeting. So from my side, there is a plenary at 2. So members are expected to be joining that plenary. And then this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thank you to everybody in attendance. Bon voyage.
Thank you, Chair.
Recording stopped.